This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. To watch and hear a finely calibrated marching band on the field is a thing of beauty, but there are a lot of finicky details to address in getting to that level, and there's a paradox as well.
When we first start the show, you don't see as much because there's more mistakes. And as we get closer and closer to a performance, you start to notice those more and more because more people are doing the correct thing. So then all of the little things that aren't quite right when somebody's a little bit out of step or a little bit late with their feet or isn't turning on the right count, it becomes very, very obvious.
Polly Middleton talks with GLT's Ryan Denham about her new role as the marching band director. Plus, the Evergreen Cemetery Walk by the McLean County Museum of History kicks off this weekend. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A century ago, in April of this year, the United States entered World War I. More than 5,000 people from McLean County served in the Great War, or about 7% of the population then. World War I is the theme of this year's Evergreen Cemetery Walk, put on by the McLean County Museum of History. Museum Education Coordinator Candace Summer says all of the characters have a connection to the war. Soldiers, nurses, or people back in McLean County supporting the war.
Through fund drives, volunteering their time to support the Red Cross and make supplies, cutting bandages, I mean, a lot of different things. But it's not just about the rah-rah, we won the war, we fought the good fight. It's telling the stories about the darker side of the war as well, where you had citizens, primarily African Americans, who weren't treated the same but still went to fight for a country where they weren't equal, and wondering if when they came home it would be any different than when they left, hoping that maybe their service would help the treatment become better.
Did that turn out to be the case?
No, sadly, no. It would, if you want to say the treatment got any better, then yes, it did, but it would take many more years before they would get their civil rights.
Who is that? Who gives that picture?
So that would be two brothers, Edward and Lincoln Bynum, who fought side by side in the front line trenches in France in the 370th United States Infantry, which was one of the all-black units that fought in France.
And how do we know how they felt about things afterwards?
We have some of their own writings during the war and after the war. We know that while there was a big victory parade and celebration when they came back in Chicago and both locally, we know through historical records and oral histories that it took a long time for things to improve for African Americans in this country.
You mentioned cutting bandages. That's an example of how retail and cottage industry certain kinds of things were in that era, even though it's only a century ago and post-industrial revolution. Would you enlarge on that particular aspect of how preparations had to be dealt with in, with a huge investment of people hours?
There was one big overarching organization that came out of the war, and it was called the Council for National Defense, which was founded in 1916, before we even entered the war, kind of as prepping. I know I'm misquoting President Wilson, but he's basically, you know, preparing for a war, you know, is the best thing to do, even though you're not fighting it right now. And so this particular group at the national level, which was made of, you know, like the Secretary of War and bigwigs like that, helped found state-level organizations. And then the state-level organizations founded county ones and town ones. And so they all worked together to organize supply drives, fund drives, things like cutting bandages through the Red Cross and the YWCA, all these little activities that were needed to support, you know, not just sending our troops over eventually, but also support our allied nations with the supplies and the money they so desperately needed. And so you have to have a big thing like that to kind of organize all the little groups as well. And this was, you know, voluntary, highly encouraged voluntary services that people were giving towards the war effort.
What did the people in this year's cemetery walk come back from the war to do? What did they become?
There's a variety of things our cemetery walk characters this year came back to do. Roland Reed, this poor guy, had a lot of bad luck. He tried to volunteer for the military on several occasions, but was rejected every time because of his poor eyesight. Signed up for the draft like everybody was supposed to, all the men were supposed to, again rejected because of the eyesight. He went on to serve for the French, but then when he came home, he ended up working for his father, Gebert Reed's portable elevator company, and when his father died, took it over.
A portable elevator?
Yes, the like the grain augers you see in the farm fields. His father ran the portable elevator company that would manufacture those pieces locally. And he took over after his father died, and the company wasn't quite so successful anymore when Roland was running it, and started basically a slow progression downhill until Roland passed away and someone else took over the company and helped revitalize it. Carolyn Church Geneva continued her career as a nurse, working at Brokaw and St. Joe's Hospital. And she did that off and on during the Second World War as well. The Bynum brothers had a lot of different jobs throughout their lives. Edward primarily served as a porter and a laborer, and Lincoln, he worked at Clay Dooley Tire as a janitor later in life. He also was a police driver for a time during his earlier life.
Candace Summer is the education coordinator for the McLean County Museum of History. The museum identified 180 people associated with the war who were buried in Evergreen Cemetery. As part of the cemetery walk this weekend and next, all those graves are marked with poppies and flags. Dean and Cindy Brown are a couple who are acting in the cemetery walk. They play a married couple, Carl and Julia Vrooman. Cindy says she relishes the opportunity.
It's a challenging experience. I can't minimize that, but it's also, I think, probably one of the most rewarding. It's like being a history teacher for like 7 days, you know, to children and interested adults, and in that beautiful setting out there in Evergreen Cemetery. It's an incredible experience.
What are the challenges to it, Dean?
I think one of the biggest challenges is the fact that we're doing the same 6.5-7 minute scene over 100 times and try to keep it fresh as well as keeping our mind in the game, as it were, so you don't get to the point where you're saying, did I say that already? Have I said that already before? Because if for each of the quote performances, we'll perform it on the weekends, we'll perform it 6 times, and during the week it'll be 5 times. And during the week when the students are coming, we do 3 performances. So it's 15 times in a day.
That's a fairly long run.
Yeah.
Tell us about the characters you'll be portraying.
Well, I'll be portraying Julia Vrooman. And the research that the McLean County Historical Society provides for us is just, it's incredible. It's in-depth. And so you really feel like you get to know these people. And they were remarkable people, active, of course, not only in World War I, but active in the life of this community and this country in so many ways. The Romans were very charitable people, very well-traveled people. And, of course, we also have the advantage of being able to go to the Roman mansion. I was there on Sunday for about an hour and a half, going through photographs and going through the house and the room where Julia Vrooman was born and died. And I mean, it's a feeling of responsibility, of course, but to explore the lives of these people and to hopefully, with obviously a certain amount of artistry and responsibility, represent them is really so much fun.
And I portray Carl Vrooman, who was extremely important to agriculture in this country back at that time. He was a Secretary of Agriculture under President Wilson, for example. He wrote a pamphlet that was distributed to farmers all over the country that helped turn farming into more of a business. And during the First World War, which they want to emphasize for this year's cemetery walk, during the First World War, he came up with the idea of what he called war gardens, where people at home would plant gardens vegetable gardens in their yards or empty lots or whatever, and to help feed themselves and feed their community so that the farmers could send their food over to Europe. Because in Europe, during the First World War, so many of the farmers left their field to go fight in the war, and there wasn't people to replace them. And so there was a huge concern about being able to feed the people of Europe during and then shortly after the war. And his idea of war gardens then helped to feed the world. In the Second World War, war gardens became victory gardens, and so that was kind of his legacy.
Will you perform a little bit of your sketch?
Oh, my. Well, in the beginning, I come out and I start singing as I'm looking for him. I haven't seen him. So I go, Carl, Carl, come out wherever you are and meet the young lady who went to the war. I went to the war to cheer up the men. And why must I do this all over again? Why must I do this all over
again? Oh, Julia, you darling woman, you do cheer me up.
Were you feeling blue?
Same old thing, Julia.
Oh, you wish you could have done more.
Yes. Sometimes I feel like such a failure. I had such potential.
Oh, Carl, you fulfilled your potential beautifully. Oh, for goodness sakes, you were the Assistant Secretary of Agriculture for the United States.
I resigned my post early.
Oh, but you were ill. Everyone understood that.
Did they? Sometimes I don't understand why I feel so unfinished.
Oh, Carl, your pamphlet on farming practices went out to 1 million people. You are a fine man, a great man.
Oh, not a great man. A good man. I tried to be.
Oh, Carl, you fed the world. Your War Gardens program helped America feed the soldiers and civilians who would have starved. Oh, think of it. In 1914, farmers all across Europe walked off their fields to fight the war. And then who was there to plant the next year's crop? Well, no one. You said it yourself. Food will win the war. And it did. All across this country, people planted their backyards and vacant lots and fed themselves in their own communities so American farms could feed the world. That was you. Your war gardens.
My war gardens? Now everybody calls them victory gardens and connects it to the Second World War.
Oh, Carl, is that vanity speaking? The victory gardens are the legacy of your war gardens. And what does it matter? You still helped feed the world. What a brilliant idea to take our surplus corn and give it to the starving world after the war. Well, Poland gave you a medal for it.
Dean and Cindy Brown are playing Carl and Julia Vroman in this year's Evergreen Cemetery Walk by the McLean County Museum of History. Following the war, the Vromans opened their mansion just off the downtown as an overflow hospital during the flu pandemic. The Cemetery Walk will perform for more than 1,800 students over the next week, as well as members of the public this weekend and next.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, reminding families that September is Life Insurance Awareness Month. You can take simple steps today to protect what matters most, from your family to your business. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, music from the Big Red Marching Machine. Several members of the first unofficial fraternity at Illinois State are celebrating the 60th reunion at the former Illidell House this weekend. The house existed between 1957 and 1972 when the present-day fraternities arrived on campus. It was home to 90-some young men during its time. House members Keith Rieger, John McIntyre, Jerry Sitar, Mickey Pro, and Jim Brownlee share their memories of the house with GLT's Brian Bloodworth. Keith Rieger, one of the first members of the house, believes it was a test for future fraternities on campus.
We were probably the first off-campus house that did not have to have an adult supervisor. I think we were kind of the test. We didn't know it at the time, but I think we were the test for the fraternity thing. We did all our own cooking and cleaning, and we actually had Dr. Bone, President Bone, and his wife over for Christmas dinner a couple times. And so I'm pretty sure we were. It was great. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. I kind of got in. I was a freshman, and I got a call from, because there was a couple guys from my hometown that were a part of it. And they just called and said, we got a spot. Do you want to come? And I kind of remember that my first year there, the tab was, because it was kind of a co-op, and the room and board was $800 for the year. Now, this is 1958. And at the end of the year, I got $200 back.
Now, how did it come about?
Don Lambert was probably the instigator of it. At least that's what I've heard. Donnie Metz, who was from my hometown, was one of the instigators, too. I think it may have been a collection of guys that said, why don't we try to do this, and let's see whether we can do it without adult supervision. Not sure what that history was, but I think we were the test. And even though we were not necessarily the model citizens, we were good at when we needed to be good, I think. So it was the best experience that I've had. I couldn't have asked for a better experience. It was a three-story old house, a lot of memories. I mean, you know, just as young guys do, I can remember I lived on the third floor, and there was five of us on the third floor. And every once in a while, Petit and Bernier, those guys were trying to get up to the third floor. It had a kind of a stairway like that. We wouldn't let them up. We were pretty dang strong. But anyway, that's kind of what I remember. I don't know how we didn't wreck the house, but we took care of how we operated and how we behaved, because somewhere along the line, somebody said, you guys are under a microscope, and you can have a good time, but if you want to live here without an adult supervision, then you're going to have to take care of yourself. And one of the reasons why we invited President Bone over was to see how we operated, because we did everything for that. But I think probably Dean Hewlett, mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether he was still there when you guys were there.
No, I reported to Dick Hewlett.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think he probably was where this got started. Somebody went to him, and he thought it was a good idea, and he said, but here's what you need to make sure that you do. The only time that there were females in the house was when we had a social gathering. And when we had a social gathering, there was always somebody else there besides us. I mean, there was an adult there. But I didn't have, at that point, my girlfriend was out of town. But nobody brought a girl there and stayed there.
House members Mickey Prohl and John McIntyre talked about the unique setup of the house.
Well, there was a rec room in the basement. I remember we had enough money left over one year. We bought a color television, and that was the date room. Everybody brought their dates over there and watched television. We'd watch the Dick Herm firm at noon with, you know, Mark Elaine to go down there and imitate Dick Herm. But then the first floor was the kitchen and dining room, and then there were two formal living rooms that we did not use unless we had guests. And I think we studied in there during finals. It was the only time we ever used that furniture. Second floor, there were four bedrooms. There were two bedrooms that had six guys in them, two that had five. The third floor was they built study carrels. Everybody had their own study carrel. And then there was a small reading room in there that eventually we converted in. That's where the grad student lived.
That's right. We hired a cook that would come in, and we each took turns. We had assignments run by our house manager on who worked in the kitchen on certain days of the week. And we had a house manager, as I recall, who was a business manager, paid the bills, a food manager as well. And then we had a graduate assistant, and I happened to have an opportunity to do that one time, who reported to the dean. And that was as close as we came then, Keith, to
That's
an
right.
adult at that
yeah.
time, and to make sure the house was operating and following the rules.
Jim Brownlee had two tours of duty in the house, one before and one after his time in the service.
But that house was fantastic. I mean, it was a very impressive house. It was at 401 Normal, I think, was the address.
Yeah.
Across the street from the Redbird Inn.
Yep.
I remember going to the Redbird Inn late at night to get cheeseburgers quite often. But the house was, you know, fantastic. And they'd built these huge beds. They were three decks, in when you were a new guy in the house. You slept on the third. And the guys that we lived with were unbelievable. We had mostly athletes. There were some that were not athletes, but we had football players, and we had baseball players, and we had basketball players. And, I mean, everybody did pretty well. And it was, you know, it was, for me, better than a fraternity.
Jerry, Jim touched on the house had a lot of athletes, and I know it wasn't total athletes or others, but how did you guys kind of recruit guys, or was it just a word of mouth?
I think it was more word of mouth, but time, we were probably the leading house on campus. People wanted to come there, so it was easy for us to recruit. I mean, we didn't have fraternities at that time, and people really just looked to us because we were the elite group at that time. And I think that's why we've continued to be close, because we were so close at that time that we're close now.
Illinois State, I think, at that time had 8,000 students.
Yes.
You know, it was not anywhere close to what it is now. And it was really a small campus, and everybody knew everybody. And our house was kind of recruited through word of mouth. Mm-hmm. I lived in Walker Hall in the dorm, and a friend of mine, Frank Martello, I don't know how they ever let Frank in the house, but he got in, and I played a lot of basketball with him in Horton, and he said, you know, why'd you think about moving into the house? I lived in the dorm, and I said, well, I don't know, and I put it in front of my parents, and they weren't too keen on me moving to a house, and I said, well, there's no alcohol in Normal, and so I think it's a pretty good pretty good situation, and I think that's how we recruited people, but it was a house that everybody wanted to be involved with, and the neat thing was, you know, all the athletes got along. Everybody supported everybody. The baseball players went to the football game, went to the basketball game. Basketball players went to the baseball games. It was a very tight-knit group, and what made Illinois State great.
There were many traditions at the house, but none ranked higher than the annual steak and bean dinner, according to Mickey Prohl and Jim Brownlee.
The grade point average in the house, the lower half ate beans, and the upper half of the house ate steak.
And he got dates.
And they brought dates. But I mean, I don't know why anybody would have ever brought a date to that thing, because the guys who ate beans, I mean, they'd come in wearing diapers, and they'd be smearing beans all over themselves.
You know, like, the guys had brought dates and had candles on the table and tablecloths, and it was a nice dinner until then the lower half of the group came in with the bowl of beans. We got a loaf of bread, too, but no utensils.
I'm guessing you guys all here in this room were in the lower half.
I represented it very well. Well, we had a high GPA. Now, we had some guys that were pretty sharp in the in the classroom. Yeah. And then we had some guys that were very average.
So did your parents visit the house?
Yeah, we had, I mean, Dad's Day weekend. We always had a lot of people, a lot of families come. They always had a big thing on Mother's Day.
Yeah.
I mean, that was when we went to school. All the way to June. We didn't get out on May the 8th, but yeah. And, you know, the parents are really supportive. I mean, they used to like to come down, and, you know, moms would send stuff down with guys. Sometimes they'd share it, sometimes they wouldn't.
Now, Mickey, I understand you were kind of at the tail end of it, and you kind of helped it transition to the fraternity when the fraternities kind of came in. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, Jerry and I were... I moved out in 68, and I think in 70 or 71 is when they colonized, and they became Sigma Phi Epsilon, and that did not end well. But anyway, Dick Barsema and I decided that we wanted to kind of stay involved in that, so we were on the alumni board for Sig Ep, and then actually Barsema and I went through initiation, which is an interesting experience, but sorry. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the guys that were really involved in that transition were, I know, Warren Gerdes and some of those guys that were right there at the end. So.
But did the fraternity system kind of come to you guys and look at you as a model? Am I correct in that?
Well, yes and no. At that time, fraternities were popping up on campus. And they really, the guys that lived in the house at that point didn't feel like they could compete without being a national fraternity. we had some fairly heated discussions, you know, about that, because, you know, they were telling us, well, you know, we can't recruit the kind of guys we want to recruit unless we're a national fraternity and we have a new house. And you know, like John said, you know, we really kind of felt like it wasn't so much about the house we lived in. We took darn good care of what we had, and it was really that brotherhood, I guess, or fellowship that we had in there was a lot more important to us than the house we lived in.
Ellidale House members Keith Rieger, John McIntyre, Jerry Seitar, Mickey Prohl, and Jim Brownlee sharing memories of the house with GLT's Brian Bloodworth. They're having a 60th anniversary reunion this weekend.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Hi, I'm Linda Bolivar, a GLT contributing listener. I give to GLT because it's important to me that we have high-quality local news like Sound Ideas to keep our community informed. I appreciate their coverage of the Multicultural Leadership Program and love having access to National Public Radio on the air and online. The GLT Fund Drive is underway. Now is the time to make your contribution to support GLT and NPR. Click on donate at WGLT.org.
Local support, including contributions from listeners like you, makes up 50% of GLT's operating budget. That's the money we use to pay for the news, information, and entertainment you depend on. We can't do what we do for you without your help. Please contribute what you can right now at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Anyone can pick up a trumpet and spit out a few notes, but try making beautiful music while high-stepping, twisting, and turning across a giant football field surrounded by 300 of your closest friends. Fall is finally here. That means the Big Red Marching Machine is back in action. And as ISU's marching band prepares for another home game this Saturday at Hancock Stadium, and then the homecoming parade, Big Red has a new leader. GLT's Ryan Denham chats with Bloomington Normal native Polly Middleton about her new role as the marching band director.
So far, it's going great. Fantastic kids to work with, fantastic faculty to work with. And, you know, all of our interactions have been great. The community's been really receptive. At our first football game, athletics was really, really supportive. The community was really supportive in a way that I haven't experienced at other schools. So that was it was a great surprise. And it sort of drove home how supportive everybody is, I think, of the Big Red Marching Machine. But so far, it has been a really great first season.
So this time of year, you got football, the homecoming parade is probably when Big Red is most visible to the campus community and Bloomington Normal at large. Can you talk about the work that your Big Red students kind of put into those halftime shows, those parade performances, the rehearsals and all that?
There is so much behind the scenes that goes into every single performance that you see, whether it's a parade or a pep rally or a halftime show at a football game. So there's a lot of work that goes into all of those. And it's a real testament to the students because they put in that time to make it successful. We all want to have a really successful product. We all want to have each performance be the very best we can possibly do. So there's a lot of work that goes into it. And obviously, this is the point of the season where we have a lot of those extra things. We have homecoming parade. We have homecoming pep rallies. We obviously have our homecoming game. We have football games coming up. And so we really have to be very focused and very efficient in our rehearsals just to make sure that we hit on all of those performances so that we really are giving everyone our very best.
You grew up in Normal, had some exposure to ISU, and probably saw Big Red performing when you were a kid. What was attractive to you about this position and that made you want to come and work for ISU and direct Big Red?
You know, the best attraction for this was the actual job itself. I love marching band. I love athletics bands. That's just what I really like to do. And so in that respect, I knew the Big Red Marching Machine is a great marching band. And to have the chance to work with that and these caliber of kids was really, really attractive to me. I know the School of Music here is first rate. I know it's fantastic. Again, the faculty are really, really great, and the work ethic and the talent of the students is also really high. So having a chance to come and be a part of that was really exciting. You know, having a chance to be back in my home state and my hometown, that was attractive too, but it wasn't my primary draw. The primary draw really was the job and the school.
The Big Red Marching Machine, most folks might not realize this, and not all the students are music majors in the marching band. They come from kind of all walks of life, all majors. You talked about your own passion for marching bands, athletics bands. Can you talk about that? I mean, where'd that come from?
You know, I think a big part of it is just the great sense of community that's in a marching band. So all of those students, regardless of their backgrounds, regardless of where they went to high school, regardless of their high school experience and their major in college, come together and work really hard to put on this great performance and to have a great show. And it's really fun to be a part of that. It's great to see the friendships that they develop. It's great to see how they support each other and work together. And I think being a part of that experience for me is really rewarding. I loved that when I was in high school and in college. I loved being in marching band. I loved that aspect of it. And, it's something that I love to do today. And I think, you know, for a lot of people, they may not have an opportunity to see some of the fantastic music programs that Illinois State School of Music puts on. They may not experience firsthand some of those ensembles and the talent that the students and faculty have, but the Big Red Marching Machine reaches a really wide audience in the community, and so people will have experience with that. So I think it's really important to represent the school and the community and the School of Music to the very best of our ability, so people see that and know, the high standards that the School of Music has.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Polly Middleton, the new director of the Big Red Marching Machine at ISU. Polly, it's a lot of students in the Big Red Marching Machine. I mean, how many students are in the band altogether when you account for everybody?
We have just over 300.
Wow, and that includes musicians, color guard, that's everybody.
It includes everybody. So we have wind players, which would be our woodwinds and brass. We have our drum line, which is our percussion. We have two twirlers. We have color guard, and we also have a dance line.
So in your opinion, what makes a really good marching band? How can you tell?
Well, there's two main elements for a marching band. There's the musical element, and there's a visual element. Obviously, the band is playing, and the band is also moving. In my mind, the music is always the first priority, and whatever is happening visually needs to be supportive of what's happening musically. So those are the things that I think most people look for. Everybody can hear if a marching band sounds good or doesn't sound good, and most people can see if a line is straight or if a line really isn't straight. So, that's what I'm thinking about when I'm designing shows, and that's what we're thinking about when we're learning the shows, making sure that musically we're doing what we need to do and that the visual element is supporting that.
Say you're watching a performance on a football field. You're looking at Big Red on a big football field.
Yeah.
Can you actually see the little things that are going on within that mass of people, the musicians and what they're doing? Can you see if somebody takes the wrong step or makes a great turn? I mean, are you seeing all of that?
Yes, for sure. The kind of the neat thing, and I'll tell the students as we go through the process, so when we first start the show, you don't see as much because there's more mistakes. And as we get closer and closer to a performance, you start to notice those more and more because more people are doing the correct thing. So then all of the little things that aren't quite right when somebody's a little bit out of step or a little bit late with their feet or isn't turning on the right count, it becomes very, very obvious. So the closer we get to a performance, the more obvious it all becomes.
Can you talk about one of your favorite shows that you've designed, either for Big Red or from a previous school that you've worked at?
The shows, I think, are a real labor of love. So for me, when I design a show, sometimes I've arranged the music. A lot of times I get the music prearranged. It's usually arranged specifically for that ensemble. And then the drill design typically takes anywhere from 24 to 30 hours for a show. So it's a big commitment. So typically every show kind of has a special place in your heart.
Yeah, hard to choose among your own children, yeah.
It is. I actually have this show that we're getting ready to perform for the September 30th football game. We'll also perform again at our high school band day, where we invite 42 high school bands to come and they compete in a marching band competition. And so we'll perform this show at an exhibition performance. And it is a great show. It's called The Way to Normal, and it's three Ben Folds tunes. And the drill is spectacular. The music is really, really cool. And we're having a great time putting it together. So that's something that I've enjoyed a lot, and I know the students have really enjoyed it too. I have a couple of ideas for shows for next year that I'm really excited about. And we have some great shows. I'm really looking forward to Homecoming this year as well. It's a classic rock show, but the music is fantastic. And that will also include some alumni of the Big Red Marching Machine joining us in performance. So that'll be a really fun show too.
What has been the biggest challenge for you getting acclimated to the position during a busy fall semester?
Well, I think the thing that is most difficult is I like to feel like I know what's going on. And so there's a lot of elements where I have not felt like I know what's going on. I'm really, really lucky that I work with, again, great students. The leadership team for the Big Red is fantastic. And so they're really helpful. We have great communication and meet regularly so they can kind of let me know some of the pitfalls or things that I may not realize are coming up. I also work with Dr. Ben Stiers, who has been here at the university for 5 years, and he's been fantastic. He's the assistant director of the Big Red and does a great job, so he's helped tremendously. But a lot of it is just sort of the feeling of, you know, you're kind of going hour by hour just to make it all come together. So that has been challenging, but I'm blessed to work with fantastic people who make that happen. So
Big Red has a very long history, a very special history for the university. Where do you want to take it in the future?
You know, great marching bands are typically measured in visibility. So we've all seen, you know, YouTube clips of things that like the Ohio State Marching Band has done. And I think that there's room for great marching band performances to get out so that people can see them and so it can be visible. And I think that's one thing that the Big Red Marching Machine needs to do. I think we've got a great support in the community and within the state, but I think we can do things that make us more visible outside of that. We can do that with social media. I think we can do that with some exhibition performances that take us to a more national stage. Last year, the band traveled to Ireland and performed in the St. Patrick's Day Parade. And there's a couple of performance opportunities I'm looking at that are overseas that I think would be a really good fit for this group. But I think getting a chance to, you know, get out and let people see what we're doing here is important. And I think that's a goal that I certainly would like to see happen in the next few years.
That's Polly Middleton, the new director of the Big Red Marching Machine at Illinois State University. I'm Ryan Denham.
Big Red Marching Machine performs at halftime during Saturday's Redbird football game at Hancock Stadium. You can also see them in action during the ISU Homecoming Parade October 21st. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You might have heard about people who talk to trees, but can trees speak? Biologist David Haskell spent a year studying trees across the globe, paying the minutest attention to their movements, growth, and sounds. He found trees do communicate. They send out pulses like the vibrations of vocal cords. Here, Haskell used a high-intensity sensor to listen to the roots of a palm tree growing on a sand beach. Haskell will be talking about his new book, The Songs of Trees, Tuesday night. That's October 3rd at Illinois Wesleyan University. In this Skype interview, he tells GLT's Judy Valente we can learn much about our world and ourselves from listening to trees.
The trees have voices in many different ways. The most obvious and perhaps the most familiar is the voices that are evoked by the wind and the rain in trees. And of course, every tree has its own wind sound and its own sound in the rain that reveals its physicality. It reveals how stiff or thick or fine the needles and branches are and the leaves are. And so the voice, in attending to the voice of the trees as the wind moves through them, we can learn something about the being of that tree, about what it is, how it relates to its environment, and how it differs from other trees. Just as each bird species has its own sound, its own voice, and of course every human individual does, so too the tree voices.
What you did that I thought was so extraordinary was you detected these pulses even within a single twig, and then you translated those pulses into sound. What gave you the idea to do that?
For one of those experiments, I took an ultrasonic detector and hooked it up to the branches of a tree, and could hear the sounds of distress, of drought within the twig, or kind of a little crackling, ultrasonic crackling sound that emerges as water vessels within a twig break. At another scale, I hooked up a little caliper to a very ordinary maple twig. And this twig, it turns out, is pulsing through the day and the night. So it gets thinner during the day as water moves through the twig from the stem out to the leaves. And then it fattens up at night as the water stops flowing. So there's an analogous process to the pulsing in human arteries or in our veins. And so I measured that pulse by measuring the diameter of the twig, expanding and contracting, and then converted that into sound by turning those measurements of diameter into piano notes. So the fatter the twig, the higher the sound. The thinner the twig, the lower the sound. So you can hear a 24-hour cycle of high sounds and low sounds as the twig expands and contracts.
I felt as if the tree was speaking to me.
Yeah, so we hear all sorts of voices in the tree, and some of those, of course, are things that we are projecting onto the tree. We've regarded trees as important metaphors for human truths and for human symbols for many years. But in a sense, trees are speaking not necessarily to humans, but to others, particularly to insects and to other trees. They're communicating through chemical means about invasion of insect pests, or about the drought or an infection of viruses and so forth. So trees are, in fact, humming within information.
You call trees nature's great connectors. What did you mean by that?
So we're learning more and more in biology now that we're all not just interconnected one with another, but we're in fact made from those connections. If you take the connections away, life ends. And this is true for bacterial cells, it's true for human bodies, and it's particularly true for trees. And one of the reasons I chose to write about trees is that they're such great examples of this. For a tree to survive to be 300 or 400 years old, it has to do a great job of communicating with the other creatures that are around it. The tree doesn't have the option of moving away as animals do. The tree, of course, is literally rooted in one spot. It has to get along with its neighbors. And so they are the nexus, the center for thousands, tens of thousands of interconnections. Those connections are happening at a microscopic scale. They're also happening at a global scale as the tree interacts with the environment around it, particularly the atmosphere and migratory animals. And so through the lives of trees, we come to see that we are all interconnected in ways sometimes that are very cooperative. Other times that those interconnections are full of drama and tension and parasitism. This isn't a big love fest among the creatures out in ecology.
Well, there's all sorts of fascinating little facts that you point up in the book, and one is that a violin, a cello, is a tree. We don't think of that.
Absolutely. When we're listening to music, what we're hearing are the vibrations of wood transmitted through the, say, from bowing on a violin string. So we're hearing the work of a musician. We're hearing the composition of the composer, of course, in music. But we're also hearing the particularities of the place where the tree grew. People who make musical instruments understand that they're working intimately with the details of how trees grow. Some kinds of wood make really beautiful sounds, other kinds of wood won't make good sounds at all. And a luthier, somebody who builds instruments, understands that we're hearing the voice of the forest as well as the voice of the musician and the composer.
You seem to have an emotional connection to the trees that you write about. Are there any particular trees that stand out in your memory?
Two trees that really connected with me in the deepest way were two trees in very contrasting environments. One is in the Amazon rainforest, where
I experienced just an incredible sensory overload through my ears, my eyes, my nose, all my senses. So my experience at this particular tree, particularly climbing into the canopy, up through the layers of humidity, through the stinging ants and the bees, all the way into the canopy, hearing the voices of the monkeys and the birds waking in the morning, all of this revealing itself, it, almost like walking up through geologic strata or layers, up into the very upper branches of the tree, 60 meters above the ground, 150 feet above the ground, extraordinary exaltation of biodiversity. And the other tree, I would say, is at the other end of the spectrum of biodiversity. It was on a street corner in Manhattan. Half a dozen species of bird that interact with that tree. And that tree turns out to be very central in the lives of the people in that part of Manhattan, in all sorts of obvious ways and less obvious ways. The tree changes how people move and interact on the street. So human social networks are in part a product of the trees, of the trees' social dynamics. Put your hand up to the trunk of a tree after a rain has come to the city, and you pull away your hand and you see a slurry of ash that's been running down the bark of the tree, almost like the tree has been burning. That is all the pollutants that the tree has taken from the air, from our lungs, and has adhered them to its body and is washing them in, down to the ground, to the soil, and into the rivers around the city. So all kinds of ways in which a tree weaves its life into the particularities of human experience in the city.
You mentioned the disappearing forests. What other public policy applications did you stumble upon, discover as a result of your research? What do we need to be doing as a matter of public policy?
Yes, one thing, a general thing I would say is that policy is often derived by people who have little to no experience of the forests themselves. So the forest is encountered on a spreadsheet or a government white paper or in a scientific paper. And those spreadsheets and papers are very important, that rational analysis of the land through the mind. But if that is done by people who have no haven't smelled the soil, haven't spoken with the people indigenous to an area, haven't understood the various perspectives of loggers and environmentalists and bird watchers and hunters and farmers, if we are making decisions in a way that is unrooted from the land, those decisions are unlikely to be wise. They're unlikely to have good outcomes. So one overarching recommendation I would make, and it's not just me, of course, many people have made this recommendation, is we need to reconnect people with lived experience of the community of life in which we're embedded. How could we possibly make good ethical connections without that lived experience?
Well, this all goes to the major conclusion I think you come to after your journey with the trees, is that all of life is made from a network of relationships. And you say individuality is an illusion.
From a biological perspective, we're learning that in many ways, the individual is an illusion. The individual, say the human body, cannot exist alone. We can't exist psychologically alone, and biologically we can't either. You take away the bacteria that dwell in and on our bodies, and we become very ill very quickly. We don't develop right. Our physiology can't function correctly. So we're made out of connections. We're walking communities in many ways.
Where did the title The Songs of Trees come from?
The Songs of Trees came from several places. One is a very literal interpretation of the sound of trees. By listening to the sounds emerging from trees, I found I could unpack some of the layers of that tree's lives and come to understand it in an intimate way. A song, though, is also the stories behind all those sounds, particularly the human stories. How are people connected to trees in differing and interesting ways in different parts of the world?
What inspired you to take on this project?
Partly, it was listening to birds. Birds were the gateway drug into listening to trees. For many years, I've taught a course where I encourage students to listen to birds, to learn their individual sounds, to become more aware of the zoological community in which we live. And in doing that, I learned, well, also the trees in our neighborhoods also have very different sounds. And there are all sorts of interesting reasons why those sounds differ. And so from a study of
the acoustics of animals, of birdsong, I came to realize that the trees also had a voice that was worth listening to in a literal way, but also in a metaphorical way. When we listen to trees, we're listening to some of the rules of ecology, some of the history of the evolution of the world. And in doing that, we're coming to know our neighborhood, our family, our community, and hopefully through that practice of listening, coming to a wiser way of approaching the world.
David Haskell teaches at Sewanee, the University of the South. He is the author of The Songs of the Trees. I'm Judy Valente.
David Haskell is speaking Tuesday at 7 in the Hanson Student Center at Illinois Wesleyan. The talk is co-sponsored by the John Wesley Powell Audubon Society and the Illinois Wesleyan Environmental Studies Program. Haskell's also the featured speaker Wednesday at a 50th anniversary celebration of the Parklands Foundation. The Parklands event begins at 5:30 at the Doubletree Hotel in Bloomington. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast. That's WGLT.org. And the individual stories and interviews from Ryan Denneman and Judy Valente. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal and WGLT.org.